My guest today is Patrick Ferenga, the president and publisher of Growing Without Schooling magazine and a repeat guest on this podcast. Welcome back, Pat.
Hey, thanks for having me, Blake. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. For those who don't know you and your work, can you give us a quick intro?
Certainly. I started work back in 1981 at Holt Associates, and my first job was to unpack the hardcover editions of Teach Your Own, which were just coming through the door. And now, 40 years later, I'm writing the third edition of Teach Your Own. The book has been continuously in print since then. And I revised it in 2003, and I'm now revising it again in 2021. So it's been a part of me.
Listeners who don't know John Holt or Growing Without Schooling, could you also tell us a quick bit about those?
Certainly. John Holt was a private school teacher who wrote a book called How Children Fail about his experiences teaching in fifth grade and how fear and the testing regime of the schools created what he called a charade of learning, where everyone is careful not to forget what they studied until the test is done, and then everyone forgets it. And that book led him to some great fame. And then a second book, How Children Learn, which has celebrated its 50th year in print. How Children Fail is still in print, but How Children Learn seems to just continue selling. And what John did there was write about what children, how children learn before they go to school and what that's like and how school alters that in many cases for the worse. And so those two books sort of established John as a school reformer, which he was until the late 70s when he gave up on schools and he was sort of writing books about children's rights, like Escape from Childhood and then Instead of Education, where he was talking about how else. What are other ways that we can help children learn besides telling them to sit down, shut up, and do as I say? And these books led him to the homeschooling movement because he was always looking for ways to help children escape. In fact, he called for an underground railroad to help children escape the harmful effects of
That's
compulsory
wild.
Schooling.
Yeah.
And he wound up finding out that there was this large number, although they were very disparate, of homeschoolers in the United States. So he started a magazine for them called Growing Without Schooling in 1977. And then that led to him to write the book Teach Your Own in 1981, which uses many, many stories that people had written into the magazine about. And then John died in 1985 from cancer. And I took over the business and became a publisher and published the magazine until 2001. So for another 16 years, we continue. And Growing Without Schooling is the first publication about learning at home, probably in the world. I mean, you know, there were books written about learning at home, but not magazines, ongoing publication at that point. And even then, like, there weren't too many books about teaching kids at home. I mean, we found some from the 1920s, you know, Rita Sherman. And then I forget the guy's name now, but in the Atlantic Monthly, he had a thing about in the 50s about teaching his children at home, but few and far between.
So this is the 40th anniversary of the book Teach Your Own. You've been doing this for four decades.
That's correct. Yep. And homeschooled my three daughters. Our oldest just turned 35 on Thursday, last Thursday.
Wow. And you know, you and John Holt were advocates more for unschooling than homeschooling, but you've had your, you know, you've been aware of this entire world of homeschooling for so long that this is why I wanted to bring you on this show to discuss this conference that's happening. And the question I want to start out with is, have you, but before we talk about the specifics of this conference, have there been previous academic conferences about homeschooling in the past? Is this just something that recurs every 5 or 10 years? Or is this really a new thing?
I think this is a new thing. There have been conferences. For instance, I spoke at one in Bogota, Colombia, that was put on, you know, for, and had some homeschool researchers and advocates and so on. But largely, you know, I'm considered an advocate, not a researcher, which of course I am. I don't engage in, you know, quantitative or qualitative research. So I would not be invited to those things, but I'm aware of them, and they've been small gatherings for you know, researchers. But there's been nothing like what happened now at Harvard, where they actually did six panels over 6 weeks, you know, and each panel's 1 hour long in a different facet of homeschooling. And that's new, you know, and especially the fact that it's open to the general public. That also is quite refreshing to me to see, because usually, you know, you get together and, you know, you recognize a few of the names from papers you've read and stuff, and you're all in a room listening to each other. But I really like the idea that, you know, there's a lot of other people listening in on this and offering their opinions and getting information. So I think this is unique. And also, of course, Blake, it started because, you know, Elizabeth Bartholet at the Harvard School of Law called to ban homeschooling in 2020. She started out of the gate with a very extreme position.
Yes, and I had her on my podcast to explain her position, and it's mm-hmm. it's a very very interesting one. I cannot say that mm-hmm. I fully disagree with everything she says. Like, and mm-hmm. we're going to get into this. Like, there's some really interesting nuance here. So I agree. I'm really happy to see this conference happening, and the fact that it's open to the public. And while it's very academic, it's very research driven. You know, everyone who's showing up to speak here is either a professor or a researcher. It does feel quite accessible. They're not using highly technical language or jargon. You do need to know a little bit of something about social science, about like how to vet statistics, but it's pretty basic. Okay, mm-hmm. so just to give an overview, this online conference, which is taking place right now as we're recording this this interview, is a seven-part, I think you said six-part, but it's a seven-part series, 1 hour each week from May 6th to June 17th, 2021, and it's called The Post-Pandemic Future of Homeschooling. And right now, in this episode, you and I are going to discuss the first 4 weeks of the conference, and then we're going to come back together again to discuss the final 3 weeks of the conference and maybe share any final thoughts we have, Pat. So I'm excited to mm-hmm. do this two-parter with you. And the first 4 weeks that we're going to be discussing today cover, is it time for a change to homeschool law? That was week one. Week two was growth and diversity in post-pandemic homeschooling, or as they described it when they were actually running the session, trends in homeschooling. Session three was, are homeschoolers prepared for life? And they took a very conventional definition of life, meaning academics and like measurable socialization skills and ability to perform in college. And then finally, week four was, are homeschoolers socially isolated? And week one, tell me if you agree, was by far the most like fireworky, most interesting. Like there was like some arguing. There was a lot of like conflicting strong views in week one because they were really asking the million-dollar question: like, do we need to change laws regarding homeschooling in the United States?
Yeah. And also it featured lawyers instead of researchers.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty much everyone else since then has been, I'd say, cut from the same cloth. You know, they're academics, mm-hmm. you know, researchers doing relatively small studies. And I'd say that a lot of them are fairly friendly to homeschooling. But in week one, we had Professor Bartholet herself, who's calling for the most extreme forms of oversight and regulation, and also her friend, Professor Jim Dwyer, who is another person who I had on this show previously, who mm-hmm. is a bit less extreme, but definitely still calling for a change in homeschooling law. And so I wanted to actually skip week one and get into week two with you, Pat, because I think that week one will give us so much to talk about, and it actually connects to these other weeks, that let's circle back to that one and start with week two. Okay, cool. So week two was about trends in homeschooling, and this was essentially who homeschools nowadays. And I want to first find out from you, Pat, did you learn anything that surprised you?
No. A lot of this is the same stuff that I've been hearing for 40 years. We don't have enough data to make decisions. We don't have enough respondents, you know, coming to this. And it's confirmed some stuff for me, but
What did it confirm for you?
Well, first of all, that homeschooling works after 40 years of watching people do this, that, you know, the academics are still saying the same thing, that it doesn't seem to harm or do anything, make you any better. They're sort of agnostic.
That sounds like you're getting into session number three right there. The like, are homeschoolers prepared for life question? In the second session, I think they were really trying really hard just to describe, like, how do we know who is homeschooling and how many people are homeschooling and what kind of people are homeschooling? Like, how do we even ask these questions in the first place?
Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting, having the statistician from the U.S. Census, talk about like the issues. And I believe it was in one of the sessions that followed that, Dr. Kunzman picked up on it, talking about like problems with the Pulse survey, which they brought up the second session. Yeah, which show that like correct me if I get this description wrong, but basically they've been following the numbers of homeschoolers, and we've all always seen this number 3%. You know, it's been around for a decade at least. 3% of the school age population is homeschooling, and now they did a survey which they call the Pulse survey during the pandemic, and I guess it showed that the number was doubling or tripling at that point.
And I think the initial number that they found in spring 2020 was about 5% of families reporting any sort of homeschooling. And then by fall 2020, that number had jumped to 11%. And I think specifically this means, like, do you have at least one kid who is doing some form of homeschooling in your household? And then they went on to say, like, but this is very experimental, new research. It's a low response rate. Like, don't put all your eggs in this basket yet.
Right. And also that there was a problem with the questionnaire. Apparently you can answer, I am homeschooling my child, and also answer, my child is enrolled in public school, because both were true for someone in the pandemic at that point. And that's very confusing. So that screws the data right there.
Yeah. Something that really stood out to me from Sarah Grady, who's that surveyor you mentioned, who does the National Center for Education Statistics work, which is, you know, ever since I started looking into this stuff, that's been the gold standard for like how many homeschoolers are there in the United States.
Right.
And I had this idea that some census survey was going out to millions of families and asking them, do you homeschool? And then I am shocked and a bit alarmed to learn from Sarah Grady that, well, it's very difficult to get high quality survey data, randomized data from the US population. Mm-hmm. And so they would send out something on the order of, I think it was 50,000, but on the order of tens of thousands or maybe 100,000 surveys, just completely randomly to addresses chosen out of databases. So they have no idea who they're sending this stuff to via postal mail. And then they're asking people to then respond to this online, but only, it's an education survey. It's about schooling. And so all the families who don't have kids or don't have kids in school, they're immediately out. And so it just gets winnowed down and down and down. And then there's people who start the survey and they don't finish it. And so in the end, where this 3% number has come from is like something like 550 families. Like, that's the total sample size of the NCES study. And then 3% of those 500 something families are the ones who are declared to be homeschooling, and the ones from which we get the demographic information about income and race and all this other stuff that gets prominently shared online as like, here are the solid statistics for who's homeschooling in the US. I was shocked by that. Did you know that the sample size was so low, Pat?
I did know that. But again, like that's always been part of the problem. And, you know, the feds, you know, the federal researchers are saying we need better state data, you know, and I guess that's true. But at the state level, you know, so much of this, you know, I think this is where like people like the lawyers would really want to jump in. You know, if you don't have a representative number of how many people are homeschooling in the state, how do you get the national number? I mean, it's still guesswork, you know, but at the same time, you know, we have this patchwork of state homeschooling laws, which is why like that first session kind of bothered me. It bothered me on two levels, Blake. One, just because I've been in this for so long and I've homeschooled my own children. You know, my wife and I did, and you know, we've had a great, you know, it worked out very well for us. And our kids went to school sometimes, came out. You know, we've been all over the map with this, and it still bothers me that a bunch of people who've never homeschooled and whose whole basis is about getting, you know, and their jobs, everything is based on college. And so therefore college is the be all and end all of their educational experience. And they're judging parents, you know, like myself, I'm pretty urban, but you know, I think like families living in rural areas, I mean, they have a completely different experience of homeschooling than I do in Boston. And you know, to just make this idea that we are the experts and you know we're going to tell you what you should be doing, I was really kind of put off by that. But I'm glad to see that there is very little of that attitude coming across. A few people it comes across, you know, when they present and in some of the writings, but
no, there's, you know, very little. There's very little like condescending. There's very little saying like those people. No.
I was really, you know, pleased by that. And, who's the moderator? Peter Parkinson? Is that his name? Or Paul Parkinson?
Paul Peterson.
He's been an excellent, excellent moderator.
I agree. Feel.
He's really done a great job of keeping everything fair.
Yeah. And he's from the Harvard Grad School of Ed. And so that's nice to see. Yeah,
exactly. You know, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to someone else who appeared in this second session and who has appeared in the homeschooling world for a long, long time. And this is Brian Ray, Dr. Brian Ray from the HSLDA, Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And this organization is...
And national, actually, his group is NERI, National Home Education Research Institute.
Yes, which is a front for the homeschooling.
Exactly, it was funded by HSLDA. Yes.
Yeah, and so for those of you who haven't heard of any of this before, I mean, HSLDA has been around for a long time, since the 70s, and they did a lot of
Since the 80s, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So
and they did a lot of legal battling on behalf of homeschoolers to make homeschooling legal and accessible in all 50 states. In the United States. And so they definitely deserve some credit. They're also, you know, deeply rooted in a religious approach to homeschooling. And that's definitely the main demographic that they're advocating for. Although, as far as I can tell, they're truly advocating for the rights of all homeschoolers, not just religious homeschoolers. And Brian Ray is like their like main research guy, because he has a PhD and he's published a bunch of studies. And when I started getting into this world in the early 2000s, his name popped up over and over again as like the guy who did research on homeschooling. And I thought, great, there's scientific research on homeschooling, and it shows that homeschooled kids do better academically speaking and socially speaking than kids who go to public schools. And wow, this guy has done some incredible research. That's how it appeared to me in the beginning. Pat, what's your relationship to this guy and the HSLDA? I'm curious.
Well, I've known Brian for ever since, you know, he got started. And same thing with HSLDA. I don't know the people personally, but like, I've actually met Brian in person a couple of times. Mm-hmm. When he's been in Boston and in, and we've gotten together. But, you know, Brian's research, you know, and he admits it, you know, it is limited by its sample size. And it tends to go around the, you know, the topics that, again, would favor people who want to homeschool for religious reasons and, you know, make sure that, you know, their family is, what's the word I'm looking for? Is religiously observant in their homeschooling, and so, you know, his research, you know, tended to be selective, but again, it was sample size, and he's trying to reach out and do that, but that's always been a problem with homeschooling research.
Yeah,
you know, so while I understand the criticism, it's also kind of hard to fault the guy because he's chosen to work in that smaller area, you know. But and then in the bigger area, you know, there really seems to be a political end to it, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to preserve, you know, the family's right to tell their children what to do and keep the girls, you know, home and pregnant and
that. Parents' rights approach. That's the key phrase there.
That's right. And by the way, states' rights too. They often threaten that, which again has those overtones of the Civil War and all that stuff, which really, I really wish we could figure out ways of talking about children and their place in society without always having to go back to all these concepts that seem to trump the discussion.
Well, this is why coming back to week one is going to be very interesting, because Professor Barthollet's argument is that this is about a children's rights, potential loophole. And she takes this very, kind of federal level, human rights level approach to like worrying about kids who could be abused. But we're gonna come back to that. I just wanted to comment on the state's rights versus, perhaps human rights angle here. I'm going to be a little bit more critical about Brian Ray, having never met the guy. I think that when I encountered his research and when I've seen how other people interpret his research, it's held up as like some sort of authoritative study on how homeschoolers are equal or superior to schooled students. And once I had like a basic awareness of social science research, I realized that he is not comparing apples to apples. He's comparing apples to oranges. And the most concise way to put it is, when you're looking at a normal sample of homeschoolers, you're looking at people who come from families that have a little bit more money, that have parents who are a bit more formally educated. And just those two factors alone, like, conspire to produce higher academic outcomes, for example. And so you have to take class into account, and you have to match the homeschoolers who you're studying to a similar socioeconomic bracket of schooled students. And then when you do that, you are comparing apples to apples. And everything I've seen from the HSLDA and the NHERI, their, you know, research front, they just don't lay that out there. Now, to Brian's credit, in this second session, he said, most of this work are non-representative samples of upper middle class white Americans. And I applauded him when he said that. But the rest of what he was saying, I felt, well, first of all, it was quite scattered. I found it hard to follow. His slides were not helpful. And he did a lot of defensive maneuvering against what Elizabeth Barthollet called junk science, which I'm sure that label was directed at Brian Ray and his research, but probably broadly speaking, all sorts of research in the homeschooling world. All right, there's a critical take on Brian Ray. Do you think I'm being fair here?
Yeah, Brian is, is respected researcher but in when it comes to the larger field, I think that he's going to, he's in a niche.
Yeah.
You know, and also, like me, I mean, he's an advocate, but unlike me, he's also a researcher. So he's in that weird thing. Researchers are supposed to be, but of course, like I said at the top, we have all these researchers whose careers are based on college. Naturally, they think going to college is what every child should do. So,
yes.
And then when Bartholet talks about a meaningful education, well, what does that mean? What's meaningful? Brian Ray would be the first to say teaching my child the Bible is the most meaningful thing I could do. And, right. That's a perfectly legitimate state, but I don't think that's what Bartholet means.
It's a legitimate statement for an individual to make, but not for a researcher who's supposed to be taking an objective stance on this.
Well, there you go.
Like, that makes me trust him less or anyone. I'm sorry. I guess that's my bias.
No, I get it. You're right. I mean, it flip flops between being an advocate and a researcher. And then, the ones who try real hard to be to be fair, they also come down on the side of, well, we really don't know. Like, it works for some, it doesn't seem to work for others.
Yeah. So, that's a good transition into week three, session three of this, which is Are Homeschoolers Prepared for Life? And what I really liked is that the two researchers who led this off, Christian Williams and Jennifer Jolly, they just said, we can't answer this question with current empirical data. They were being good scientists and saying, we just don't have good data, because mostly all this research is convenience samples, which means it's whoever happens to conveniently be around the researcher, accessible to their Facebook networks, or if you're a professor, you ask your undergrads to, participate in the survey.
Exactly.
Small N, so small sample size, and qualitative research. So not, doing things by the numbers, but more interviews. And that right there, convenient sample, small N, and qualitative, I mean, that describes what I consider to be the most popular research about homeschooling. And I've had both Peter Gray and Gina Riley on this show to talk about their research. And they are definitely both the first to admit it. And they say, yeah, this is, mostly convenience survey data. We're not comparing apples to apples. We're just saying that unschooling does work for at least some people out there. And here are their stories and here are their demographics. But yes, these are the people who decided to respond to this survey. And we don't know about all those other people who didn't respond to the survey or who we couldn't access. So I really like that was put on the table right there in the beginning of this session.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's important to get out, because here, but I think there's a bigger a bigger issue behind this. And that is, when school got started, compulsory school, people forget that we didn't have a whole bunch of research that showed it worked.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Come on. Horace Mann started off saying we had to teach him the Bible. Then it was getting pushback about that. It became about citizenship. And then it became about child labor and protecting, whatever rationale worked to get compulsory education laws passed, Horace Mann and his allies did it, And then we've seen over the years how this has become entrenched. And now it's what used to be a 4 or 6 year compulsory attendance law is now they want to start you in preschool and carry you all the way through college now. And then there's mandatory continuing education that some people threaten for adults.
Really? I haven't heard about that.
Oh, yeah. It's been there's a gentleman named John Olinger. I think he was at Penn State. Was writing about this in the 80s. And every now and then, he would have an article in GWS, talking about that. But yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we see this the idea of womb to tomb schooling, which, some people, advocates push for.
That's definitely an argument I use when talking with parents. And I say, well, should you have to go back to some you know, form of compulsory re-education? You know, should you have to, you know, be tested on whether you can remember what's in the Declaration of Independence every 10 years so you're still a good citizen?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, of course not. You know, that feels like the Cultural Revolution or something. And,
exactly.
And I say, yeah, yet with this is just unquestioned logic when we're talking about the first 18 years of life.
That's right.
Something else that they brought up was very interesting to me. They said, regarding academic abilities among homeschoolers, that it might be that there is a wider distribution of measurable academic abilities than you find in the school system. And that passed the sniff test for me, which means you're going to find more super high achieving, what we'd call super smart or gifted kids in the homeschooling community. And you're going to also find kids who, when using conventional academic measures, seem very underperforming. Does that pass the sniff test for you?
Yes, absolutely. And also a lot of things that are not measurable in school, such as learning across disciplines, being able to integrate various, you know, forms of information into something new, and joy in learning. I mean, there's none of that, you know, in the research, very little, let's put it that way. But homeschoolers, yeah. I mean, that's like their bread and butter.
And I imagine if there's research about personality traits, I mean, I just did an episode about that covered the topic of like twice exceptional kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's definitely, mm-hmm. you know, representative of being an outlier on the psychological spectrum, but it works so well for so many kids who don't have these, like what we'd call like, you know, neurotypical psychological profiles. And so, they didn't talk about that, but I kind of wish they did. Here's something I'm sure that you'll love, Pat. They use the phrase dropout loophole. You know, homeschooling laws may be used as a dropout loophole for students who just want to stop doing anything academic whatsoever. And I was like, yeah, hell yes. That sounds like the Teenage Liberation Handbook to me. It's like, I mean, I tell people to do this all the time. Ken Danforth does, lots of people do. Like, you want to stop doing school? Become a homeschooler. You can stop going tomorrow. Like, thank you, exactly. Dropout loophole.
Right. That's what the word unschool means. Learning that doesn't look like school or resemble school.
Yeah. Yeah. But this, you know, they were not using this phrase in a positive light.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, if I remember, they were talking about largely teenagers.
Yeah.
And, I was kind of surprised how that would work, because you do need your parents to sign off to become an official homeschooler.
Yeah.
You know, you as a child can't. So there would have to be something, you know, something there. And also, you know, I've never seen a statistic that shows like, oh yeah, this is a problem. There's a lot of non-homeschoolers claiming to be homeschoolers so they could become dropouts. I wouldn't be surprised, but I mean, you know, that kind of caught me off guard, to be honest. Yeah. It was like, well, I can imagine it, but I've never known it to be a problem. But again,
So we're still talking about Christian Williams and Jennifer Jolly, and they said that there may be evidence for this dropout loophole. And I think, of course there's a dropout loophole, but they were saying kids might be dropping out doing nothing that looks productive. And so they just didn't have a framework from like the unschooling or self-directed or de-schooling point of view to even like comprehend that, because we've talked about this before.
Right.
A few things that I liked when they were reviewing the research, they said, and they've really breezed over this one. They said, well, college GPA and retention, so, you know, whether they stay in school or not, is similar for homeschoolers and school students. And I'm like, okay, well, that's very important. Thank you for acknowledging that. And they say the socialization metrics also appear similar. And so that's good. I mean, that should really give parents, this is what I emphasized in my most recent book, Why Are You Still Sending Your Kids to School? That like all the decent research essentially says homeschooling is not going to hurt you significantly or harm your kids significantly broadly speaking. You know, of course, there's always outliers, but it's just not this boogeyman that either detractors like to imagine or proponents like to imagine. Right. It'll solve all your problems or create a bunch of problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this the way that homeschooling has been discussed over the 40 plus years that you have been in this world, Pat?
When people start comparing, like, you know, homeschoolers in college, you know, I mean, gosh, you know, I remember when I was first working at Holt Associates, I forget, it was around 1983, I think, when the Colfaxes came out with Homeschooling for Excellence, and their son had gotten into Harvard.
Or three of their kids got into Harvard, right?
Right, but the first one, Grant, I mean, it was like, I mean, I've told this story before, but National Enquirer ran a story about him because he raised dairy goats, and that was one of the things that Harvard liked about him, is that he'd written articles and you know, did such a great job in 4-H with dairy goats. National Enquirer had a headline, "Goat Boy Gets Into Harvard."
Goat Boy. Sounds like Bubble Boy.
Yeah, and in fact, he wound up going on Johnny Carson because it was so unusual. But even then, I was really surprised. There was another gentleman, a young man named Joel Fields, who was also homeschooled and who was also attending Harvard at the time.
And he didn't get an illustrious title like Goat Boy.
They didn't get the Goat Boy title, but Joel Fields, I've since learned, has become, he was a writer in Hollywood and rather successful. So, you know, it's interesting, but yeah, so this has been around a while, and again, like the whole idea that college success is the main reason of success. Look, I just finished doing the copy editing on this new edition of Teach Your Own, and one of the things I've been looking at is college. I always have, and one of the things that really hit home to me, if you look at the New York Federal Reserve, they have studies of college graduates and work, and starting in the early 1990s, something like, well, let me give you the number now. It's close to 40%, according to the Federal Reserve of New York, 40% of college graduates are underemployed, meaning they're doing work that can be done by people without a college degree. 40%. And then in that same survey, 37% of the students claim that the only reason they went to college is because their parents made them to. They did it to please their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, this whole idea that you know, college is the be-all and end-all, we really gotta get our
Yeah, well, I've written a book about this too. I fundamentally agree with you, Pat. I would love to see from that survey the percentage of underemployed high school graduates, because if that number happens to be higher, then that's like still a valid reason for people to get anxious about going to college. It's like, okay, maybe I won't use my college degree, but at least I won't be stuck with a lower credential and underemployed. But anyways, this is a tangent. Mm-hmm. So the next person who came on to comment in week three was Robert Koonsman, who I really like. I just like this guy. And I've read his stuff before. I've never heard him talk before. But the first thing he said was, we're asking this question, are homeschoolers prepared for life? And he said, which life? Whose life? What values? Can empirical research even answer this question? And he said, homeschooling is a blurry phenomenon. Families mix their approaches. They change their approaches. It's a very difficult thing to study. And so I just really appreciated that. Because everyone else was operating from a fairly standard definition of, like, prepared for life means academic success and conventional employment. So thank you, Robert Koonsman. He then went on to say that based upon the research that he's seen, and he's the co-author of one of my it is my all-time favorite academic study about homeschooling. And he co-wrote this paper called Homeschooling, A Comprehensive Survey of the Research. And it was first published in 2013, and they updated it. He and Milton Gaither, the co-author, updated it for 2020. And you can just search Koonsman Gaither homeschooling paper, and you'll find it for free online. Yep. But like, they just like look at every single piece of academic research that's out there to form like a very broad picture of the outcomes regarding homeschooling. So I really trust this guy. And he goes on to essentially confirm what the previous guests have said. And then he says that homeschooling does not change measured test scores, academic test scores, once a family background is accounted for, the socioeconomic background. Thank you. Apples to apples. But he's a bit more agnostic on the socialization and the life outcome stuff. He says that the data is very mixed and inconclusive. You can't say yes or no. So I like it. He's just a big old agnostic academic. He's like, listen, we mostly don't know. We're not even asking the right question. And even if we could, data could probably not answer this question, but at least they get similar test scores. So chill out.
Yeah, that's a good summary.
Did anything else stand out to you from this week, Pat?
Well, again, you know, the thing that got me is, you know, 40 years later, I'm still here and we don't have enough data to make a decision one way or the other. But can you say this even of someone in school? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, just because you want to be a lawyer, you may change your mind after you go to law school. And then what? What does that say about?
And just because you get good grades and then you go on and become a lawyer does not mean you have, you know, you're prepared for life. You're living the life you want. There are plenty of miserable lawyers out there.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And again, like only like 33% of Americans have 4-year college degrees. And I'm not even sure the number's that high, but that's an awful lot of people without college degrees who are somehow making a living and who need to continue making a living. You know, that's one of the things that I think, you know, is not being looked at, you know, in the research is like, you know, what's the positive end of this? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, all we hear about is like compared to school, they're okay.
Yeah.
But what about all the non-school things that they're doing, you know, and how does that help them? And how does that help society? Yeah. You know, if we're not putting our kids in segregated schools and, you know, schools have become more segregated now than they ever were, apparently, from the statistics I'm seeing, you know, how else can we, you know, put children into society and, you know, we do live in a pluralist society. And I know that, you know, a lot of conservatives will disagree with me there, but I'm sorry, you know, we have to learn to get along. And the best way to do that is to get along with people who are different than you.
And this is something that is captured by the qualitative research. So that, you know, what Elizabeth Barthollet would call junk science. And for example, the more like narrative research, one of the earlier guests, Cheryl Field Smith, was focused on African-American mothers specifically who are choosing to homeschool. And I could tell just from the tenor of the conversation that because she had mostly qualitative kind of story-based research, you know, it's like, okay, well, we don't really have numbers to talk about here, so let's move along quickly. But that kind of research, I created this project a few years ago called grownunschoolers.com, where grown unschoolers tell their own stories. The stuff that Peter Gray and Gina Riley have done, like that's all very important stuff because it shows what you were just advocating for, Patrick, how homeschoolers are often out there doing really cool stuff out in the communities. You know, I would like to believe building bridges, and they're not just like monoculture students just doing the same thing over and over again in this isolated institution. And how do you measure for that? What is the research metric for that? I don't think it exists.
Right. And I wish they would try to figure out a way to do it if it's so important, you know?
Yeah.
But apparently, you know, and that's the other thing, you know, is like, you know, look at the amount of falsification of research. I've, you know, it's just amazing how many scientific studies and research papers, it turns out are junk science by themselves. Well, and these are coming from universities.
Are you thinking about the replication crisis in social science?
Yeah.
I don't think it's quite fair to say that it's like false research. It's just that it can't be easily replicated, which is a giant problem. Like the marshmallow study about self-control. It's like, oh, we can't reproduce these results with a new group of kids and marshmallows. I agree that that's a big problem.
But meanwhile, totally. The marshmallow study holds sway, like, you know, you wouldn't believe, particularly among parents and teachers.
It confirms our narratives and these very simple concepts like grit or mindset.
Right.
You know, it's easy to get into our heads. And then for someone to say, well, we can't reproduce the fundamental studies that lead to these conclusions. It's like, oh, okay, but I really like the conclusions.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, delaying gratification, you know, is one of those things that's important, but also is very context sensitive. I mean, you know, if you delay gratification, you could be missing the bird in hand. That's worth two in the bush.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
as someone who eats large bowls of ice cream frequently, I see the limits of deferred gratification. But let's move on. Let's move on. So week four, are homeschoolers socially isolated? You were not able to attend this week, so I'll just give my quick whirlwind summary of this one. Essentially, the researchers said, well, here's a bunch of self-reported and correlational research. So, you know, we can't put much faith into it, but what we do have is positive. And it sounds like homeschoolers who are then later surveyed as adults say that they were not deeply isolated, that they were socialized in the sense of having contact with people outside the house. They don't feel like they were really abandoned. You know, they participated in sports, they use libraries, they do stuff, they're social. And so the answer was essentially, no, homeschoolers are not socially isolated, but we're only hearing from the ones who probably had decent experiences. And we are not hearing from the ones who may have had rough experiences, who were truly sheltered, who were truly isolated, because it's just hard to find these people. And even when you do find them, those are not necessarily people who want to tell you all about their lives.
True.
Yeah. So that was essentially week four. And there was a bunch of like hopeful evidence that they're not isolated, but it could be that they are.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you've been covering this question, the socialization, the isolation question, for a long time, Pat. Yeah. Have you seen the dialogue around this evolve over four decades?
No. The dialogue. No, you know, in fact, it's funny. You know, we're going to get to Dwyer and Bartholet in a minute, but you know, I'm reading his book, you know, Homeschooling, the History and Philosophy of a Controversial Practice, you know, and the first thing that leapt out at me is he doesn't once mention that John Holt wrote a book about children's rights. and everything I'm reading is that the state has to step in to protect children's rights, but what are they? And they're having, you know, it's a very, you know, it becomes abstract. All of a sudden, like, you know, you're taking parents and teachers and then throwing the state into the mix. And, you know, it really causes, it makes me wish that there was more of dialogue about the child. And you know, I mean, this is the thing, like, and again, going back to all the generalized research we've been talking about. Yeah, it's nice to have generalized research. But one of the things that, you know, pisses off researchers and academics about John Holt is he's always talking about an individual child in a certain context. He's always describing a child in his classroom or a child at home or a child with the family or children playing. And, you know, not like these aggregate numbers, you know. I mean, people, you know, in the schools of education are being taught to pull the levers, you know, of schooling to make the machinery work. And John realized, as a lot of teachers do, no, I got to work with the child, with the individuals, with their parents, you know. And that's what really, you know, sort of gets me about this discussion is that, It's moving away from being about parents and children and the relationship of children to society to parents and the government and the government's relationship to their children.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, so you've been reading Jim Dwyer's book, which he co-authored, which is just called Homeschooling. I believe the subtitle is The History and Philosophy of a Controversial Practice.
Correct.
And I really love that book, and I really enjoyed interviewing Professor Dwyer on this podcast. And so for anyone who's interested in diving deep into this stuff, and it goes deep, go back and find those episodes with James Dwyer and Elizabeth Barthollet. And maybe let's start with Dwyer, because I think Barthollet gets a bit more of the limelight. But I find Dwyer to be very, he feels very even-handed. And along with Barthollet, he says, listen, there's lots of homeschoolers out there who seem to be doing it right, and it's a positive thing. And he's the first to say, homeschooling should stick around. And in the book, he starts by discarding extreme views about homeschooling in both directions, that homeschooling is this magical pixie land, or that homeschooling is this evil, pernicious force that should be outlawed. And he said, no, it should definitely not be outlawed. But then he goes into this discussion. This is where I'm connecting to what you were just talking about parents' rights and states' rights. And he essentially says, this whole idea of parents' rights is a myth. And he says, the state has always intervened in kids' lives, either via direct kind of government intrusion or via parents. And that this position of kind of total parental, power of total parental control over a kid's education is not actually a very libertarian position. It's granting state power to parents. And anyways, he goes on to make more arguments, but I just want to know, do you accept that premise that he starts with?
You know, I have to say that first of all, you know, there is that like this common law idea that we all have just from growing up in the culture that we are, that a man's home is his castle, you know, and that, you know, there seems to be a certain inviolability about, you know, coming into my home, that, you know, in my family. So, you know, I really appreciate, you know, people, you know, from the parental rights point of view, because, you know, when does the state stop coming into your house once it does? You know, where do we draw that line?
There's a certain basic human dignity that we want to assume.
Yeah. Yes. And a right to privacy, right? I mean, you know, not everything should be exposed to the state, right? I mean, that doesn't, you know, seem to work in a modern society. But on the other hand, children are not the mere chattel of parents.
Peers versus and, society of sisters, yeah. Well, actually, right. Sorry, that's children are not the mere something of the state. I actually butchered that one.
Mere creatures of the state.
Thank
that's,
you.
Yeah, peers. Yeah. Yes. Right. So, you know, we have that thing, but what are children? We don't want to give them personhood for some reason. And John, you know, John understood that, John Holt. And so he was talking about gradually granting the children the same rights of citizenship that adults have. I don't see any of that in Dwyer's thinking or Barthollet, you know. It's very much, you know, the state must intervene, and here's how.
Yeah.
And why?
Did John Holt talk about, when he was talking about gradually giving young people the same rights as adults, did he talk about using competency tests? Because that's the most like specific policy proposal I've heard from the children's rights movement. It's like, you don't need to wait until a certain age to be able to do something. Just prove that you're capable of doing it.
I don't think John would have been into the competency test, but I don't. Yeah, I could see that as a middle ground. But you know, like John, you know, and the reason I say that is because one of the most controversial things is the right to vote, and a lot of people say that. Oh yeah, you know, they're just going to give kids chocolate ice cream and say vote for me, and they're going to get the vote.
They might get my vote that way.
Well, there you go, Blake. That's John's point. He says, isn't that what's happening right now? Vote for me and I'll lower your taxes, you know, because you're one of me. You're in the top 1%, you know? Kids can see through that just as easily as adults can, or can just as easily be bought as the adults can, anyway, I don't want to go down that path too far. That'll take us a few.
I was just going to say, we did another episode about children's rights specifically with Margie Sanderson. So that's another good one to go deep into this. Okay. So, James Dwyer's position, he says, listen, kids already receive a lot of home instruction. And I agree with this point. Like, everyone's a homeschooler fundamentally. You know, there's a lot of contact hours between parents and kids. And he said that some level of safety guarantees are important. This is where he agrees with Barthollet. And because he says there's a lot of parents out there with mental illness, I'm quoting him now, drug abuse problems, low IQ, flat earthers, people who are illiterate about how government works. And there are many adults out there who would not be allowed to adopt a child if they had to go through that screening process. And his main piece of damning research that he likes to cite is this Connecticut study, which I have not looked at again recently, in which something like 36% of homeschooling parents in Connecticut had, if a background check was done on them, they would have found some indication of child maltreatment. And so to him, he's like, how can you let parents do stuff without any oversight or regulation if maybe a third of them are, poorly treating their kids.
Right. So, yeah, this thing about there's an area in Connecticut where 36% of the homeschool children were abused. First of all, I'd like to know, I don't know that particular study. I've heard about it, in Barthollet's article, and but I've not read it, but if it's in Connecticut, I'd be very curious. Is it Westport, where all the billionaire hedge funds people live, or is it like in downtown Bridgeport, which is it can be a rough neighborhood. What do we mean by that, and so I first of all just like to know the demographic background on it, and then secondly, that is a surprisingly high number. So what's going on? Because, I've known homeschoolers for 40 years here in my neighborhood and so on. Met a wide variety of people. You really can't tell just by talking to somebody. I mean, maybe if they were really raving, you could get a hint, but what was the child abuse and who perpetrated it? I'd like to know a little bit more about that. But then also just overall, just like, yeah, I get it that there is this danger, but there's also that danger when your kids go to school. There's that danger when they go to the Cub Scouts, but is it 36% of all homeschoolers are child abusers? I can't believe that. I mean, that seems statistically crazy.
I struggled to believe that also. And actually, in the next week, week five of this conference, they're directly addressing the question of whether there's more abuse in school or in homeschooling. I'm really looking forward to that one.
And I'm going to be looking to see how they slice it, because I'm sure they'll probably go with public schools in comparison. But you've got to look at private schools too. The Catholic Church, right there, the pedophile crisis is ridiculous. And then Tony Alamo and the evangelical end, they also have their problem with child abuse in the church.
So here's how I think about this, Pat. Often I'm discussing teenagers and their preparation for the real world. And I address the question, are there a bunch of failures to launch in the homeschooling community? And I say, well, I guess it's theoretically true, but if there was this big kind of cover-up of homeschoolers, clearly because of their educational upbringing, failing to integrate into adult society, I feel like I probably would have heard about it by now. And so this is the question I want to ask you. If there was some widespread phenomenon of parents using homeschooling laws to abuse their kids in horrible ways, isolate them. I feel like you, who have been in this movement for 40 years, who have been a prominent figure, who you speak a lot about homeschooling and unschooling, I feel like you probably would have gotten at least a few emails at this point from concerned, grown homeschoolers or their siblings and saying like, listen, you really got to talk about this thing that's going on. I mean, does that seem like a reasonable assumption to you?
It does. And, you know, I've certainly heard from disaffected homeschoolers, children who were homeschooled and felt that their parents didn't do a good enough job for them. But even that's few and far between compared to the others who say, oh, thank God, homeschooling, saved my life, or, got me out of a terrible situation in school, or, helped me discover what my passion is, So, yeah, there's no big red flag going off from the community itself. But again, and we have to be careful, as you and I, aren't living in rural Idaho. I don't really have our fingers on the pulse of what's going on there. But I rather doubt that there's big amounts of child abuse going there at all.
This is why I find this fascinating, because you and I could totally be deluding ourselves right now. We could just be telling ourselves the story that we want to hear about this idea that we are inclined to believe. Like that is true. That's objectively true. That could be happening. And so then to muster evidence against that idea that we're just deluding ourselves, that's the trick. And then to do that in a way, and not just say, well, we haven't received any emails from people saying that this is a horrible thing. That's not going to convince people who are in these positions of power, who are speaking at this conference either. I remember when I did my interview with James Dwyer, he said, I was talking about unschooling leading to perfectly fine outcomes. And he said, that's great. I'd love to see the study that proves this. And I totally get where he's coming from. And at the same time, it's very, very difficult to prove that. So anyways, I just find this very fascinating.
And actually, Blake, now you make me wonder, is there a study that shows that graduating from school as major perfectly socialized person, I'm not aware of any such thing.
With all these life skills and economic security guaranteed, I agree. That's a very good point, Pat. Okay, so let's circle back to Barthollet now. Her main argument is that with the homeschooling laws that currently stand, there's no guarantee to a right of education or freedom from abuse. She does think that most homeschooling families are okay, and that there may be a significant subset of homeschooling families that do need more heavy-handed regulation to protect them, and that's why laws exist. She's a law professor. And so she wants to see, and she has a couple of different approaches she takes here. She does want to see more academic testing, but she seems more concerned about having homeschoolers be exposed to other kids and crucially to other adults. And she, I'll just put it out here. The concrete proposal that she puts out there for changing the laws that I feel most amenable to, and I'm very curious how you feel, Pat, is she said, how about homeschoolers see like two different adult mandatory reporters? So that could be a pediatrician, it could be a teacher, it could be, I'm not exactly sure how exactly you become a mandatory reporter. I know that when I've worked at summer camps, we are mandatory reporters. If we have evidence of abuse that's taking place, we have to report it to Child Protective Services. She says, why would it be so nuts to require that all homeschoolers have to go see a couple adults who can at least like have a conversation with the kid and see if there's any bruises on their body. And if so, then they can take action. So just respond to that one first, Pat.
Well, the first thing is maybe a pediatrician would be able to see bruises on a body, but we all know child abusers, especially if they're serial, know how to hide them. it's going to take, usually it's because of sullenness or withdrawal, some sort of personality change that would tip a mandatory reporter off, I would think. Although obviously a black eye would, or a broken limb would do it. But, you know, so I'm not, I completely, first of all, let me just take a step back and just, before we talk about like adding new things, let's talk about what we have. One of the things that always surprised me is John Holt, in early issue of Growing Without Schooling, was talking about how we didn't have a problem with, you know, doing a criminal background check on prospective homeschoolers.
That's interesting.
Yeah, to make sure that there wasn't the history of child abuse or something like that.
Yeah, that's before. Another concrete proposal, you know? that Bartholet and Dwyer have.
Right. And you know, and then what I hear is like, you know, and it just boggles my mind. Oh, and like you, I teach in summer camps. I teach in after-school programs. So I've had my Corey, you know, I've done the Corey reports and all that stuff. And, you know, what I hear is that, oh, those things are unreliable. You know, they're full of like, you know, bad information from, you know, disaffected spouses reporting, you know, bad, you know, lies about their spouses and so on. And I'm like, well, then let's clean it up. This should work. This is in place for a reason. But you know, even outside of you know, people teaching in summer schools or summer camps, you know, Corey, you know, the Corey stuff is apparently a real problem. You know, there's a lot of misinformation.
Can you define Corey for us?
I think it stands for I forget what it stands for in Massachusetts, but it's a criminal background check. You know, so before you can work in a public school or in a summer camp, you sign a document saying that they could do that, and then they just, you know, see if you have anything against you on, you know, in the criminal courts, and that's how I understand it works, and that seems pretty basic. But if we can't even make that work, how are we then gonna let's get the systems that we currently have in place working? Because I've heard, like, you know, lawyers say, oh, no, we can't, you know, we don't want criminal background checks because there's a lot of misinformation. Well, then what are we supposed to use? You know, why do we have to keep coming up with layer after layer? Let's get the layers that we have here working correctly. Let's, you know, and then let's see if we need more. I mean, I don't know why the magic number two is there. I mean, we always had annual checkups. And again, who's going to do the annual checkups? If we had a good healthcare system, no one would, that would not be a problem, you know?
Well,
but that's
there's also this concern about like regulatory capture. You could have a very small town doctor who is doing these mandatory reporting checkups of homeschooling kids, who's, you know, friends with all the families and is under great pressure not to report anything. So even that would not be an ideal system.
That's right. And just one for one other thing up. And this is why unschooling was such a big thing for John Holt, because it puts children in the world and puts them around adults more than they are. And this is the whole point. I mean, you know, everyone thinks that it's this antisocial experience. Homeschooling or unschooling, as John will call it, is a very social experience. It's all, you learn by being social, by being with others and doing things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that more school and more attendance is the answer, you know, there are other answers. And one is to put kids more out there so that they can be seen by more people and have more experiences and more adults to go to.
So I think if we had Jim Dwyer and Elizabeth Bartholet hang out with a bunch of unschoolers and kind of hear about their lives, they'd probably be pleasantly surprised at how out there in the world they are, but would still harbor this concern about, you know, what Bartholet calls this potentially significant subset of families that are under the radar that could be doing bad things. And this is where I think the book Educated by Tara Westover really plays a role, in the same way that the book Wild by Cheryl Strayed sent a bunch of people hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail. I think that Educated got a lot of people thinking about, well, what about that rural, like super out there family, out there religiously speaking, you know, social beliefs, beliefs about medicine, rural Idaho. These kids don't even have birth certificates. You know, there's just no one looking out for these kids. And look at this young woman managed to escape this, but think about all the other kids who might not be escaping this. You know, what about them? And I totally get that she is concerned about this shadowy possible subset of abused kids that are taking, you know, their parents are taking advantage of very lax or non-existent homeschooling laws to do bad things. I mean, how do you feel about that? When you think about these extremes, like the Tara Westovers of the world, like where does your mind go? Where does your heart go, Pat?
Well, first of all, Tara Westover's book is excellent. And
I agree.
I think that and anybody that's interested in homeschooling would get something of value out of that book. And let's not lose sight of the fact that she does get educated in her own way, and she does succeed in academic terms, despite everything that's happened to her. You know, so... You know, I think you have to look at education as more than just going to school, as, you know, as her book points out. You know, there's a lot of factors there. And then as she herself points out, one of her brothers, or two of them, left the family before she did. He got out of the mess before she realized she could. And then he wound up homeschooling his children successfully. She spoke very, very favorably of that in the book. So she's not like damning homeschooling, all homeschooling. But again, like, you know, like just talking about, you know, people talking about the averages versus John Holt talking about a specific child in a specific situation. Yeah, she was in a very bad situation. Her grandparents were aware of it. But, you know, the other thing is that she was in a community that supported that. You know, there are other families like hers. And, you know, and in fact, her parents, you know, sort of became mentors and or leaders in that community towards the end of the book. Right. They become wealthy. In fact, you know, despite like, you know, their horrible treatment of their children. And, you know, my gosh, I mean, the dad winds up disfiguring himself because of the way he poorly manages his business. You know, he nearly kills his children when they're putting up a roof.
And they have horrible car accidents and they don't go to the hospital. They just...
This is mental illness, you know? So yeah, people have mental illness, you know, but do we, you know, that if his kids were in school, would it have been any better? Perhaps, but they would still have to go home to the mentally ill dad. You know, it's a difficult situation. But again, in terms of regulation, why not like make these background checks be worthwhile? And why not, you know, have more opportunities for children besides just school or not school? You know, in order to free them up. I mean, this idea that it's either school or not school. And if you're not in school, we have to have special people looking out for you and make sure you're not hurt.
I got no better answers than you do here. And, and I'm trying to see all sides of this. And I just always end up at this place where I feel like to really step up regulation beyond something like background checks or visiting a pediatrician, we'd be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's just what my gut tells me. Also what everyone in this conference seems to be calling for, it's the perennial, you know, way to end your inconclusive result. It's like, well, more research is needed.
I
would love to hear someone answer the question, you know, what research could prove that a low level of regulation around homeschooling is acceptable?
We have states like Massachusetts that have, you know, relatively low levels. Then you have New York State, which has a high level. And then you have states like Texas, which have no level, you know. It's just, you know, so we already have like a bunch of barometers we could look at. But I don't think there's a lot of data captured about, you know, particularly in those states that have no homeschooling regulation, as to the health and welfare of the children, you know. And also, I just wonder about the health and welfare of the children in school, too. I mean, we should be concerned about children, period. You know, and coming at this with a much broader and inclusive framework than just trying to ferret out, you know, like this 36% down in Connecticut, you know?
Yeah. And I think that a great principle to move forward with is let's advocate for equal treatment regardless of educational environment. And so anything you're going to require a homeschooler to do, you should require a school student to do. Although I guess you could just turn that around and immediately say, well, let's just require everyone to go to school.
Well, yeah, I don't want to do that.
Something that everyone seems to agree with in these panels is that we do need more, like the fact that some significant number of US states, like you don't even have to register your, the fact that you're homeschooling. Everyone in this conference seems to think that that needs to change, and that just getting a basic census, a basic count of how many people are homeschooling and their basic demographics is important. Do you agree with that?
Well, part of me does, because, you know, I mean, it makes sense if you want to be complete in counting, right? But, you know, do we, you know, what I'd like to know is, does it make a difference if you have a very no homeschooling law or a very liberal homeschooling law compared to a more restrictive laws? Does that impact the homeschooling experience?
Well, you know, I don't know, Pat. I don't know if I need to answer that question before I can express a preference on like state level registration. Like the arguments that I've heard in favor of this is, what do you have to hide? You know, if you are not one of these horrible, abusive, secretive homeschooling parents, like it should be no reason that you're not going to tell the state that you're homeschooling. And from the perspective of children's rights, just, and this comes back to like states' rights and parental rights. I love this stuff. The state should know that you exist in the first place. Like that seems kind of basic to me.
Well, you know, Blake, I agree, but I want you to know, I've come to that position. And in the original version of Teach Your Own, John had a letter from a doctor in the Midwest saying that he refused to give his children birth certificates, and John supported him in that. I cut that. I've changed my opinion on that, especially you know, because I think every child should be counted as a person, should be known as an individual. And given how our society has evolved into this credentialed society, and especially after reading, I mean, I had concluded this before I read Educated, but when you get to the part of the book where she doesn't have a birth certificate and how it's like almost impossible for her to do anything in society, get into college, find a house, an apartment, do anything, you know, it's like, I mean, that's a real basic thing. Like, you know, even the ancient Romans, you know, Jesus had to go get sense, you know, be part of the census, you know. Come on, you know. But I don't have a, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But it really, you know, it really does. I mean, it's this larger issue of you know, of freedom. And again, like I said, there is no such thing as pure freedom. We all have to live within the constraints of the society or the locales that we live in, you know. But we are creating these laws, you know, or debating them now, and we have to be very careful because this is, you know, affecting people's lives, and I would like to see children protected. I would like to see them have the right to say no and not get the crap beat out of them by their parents for saying no. But at the same time, you know, what happens? There's this, you know, we're going to have the state step in and put them in foster homes. Is that really, or an orphanage, or, you know, I mean, you know, we really need to talk about like what is a child's role in our society? Are they just to be, you know, a little mini-me's of their parents, or are they truly individuals? And if they're truly individuals, how do we nurture that?
Pat Franka, this is why you are a guest on this podcast. You are asking all the right questions. I think this is a beautiful place to wrap it up. Is there anything else you wanted to throw out there before we meet again to discuss the second half of this conference?
I can't think of anything right now, but if I do, we'll bring it up at the next conversation, which I look forward to.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to watch the videos, they've been fully recorded, everything we've been discussing, just Google post-pandemic future of homeschooling, Harvard, and you'll find it. So Thanks for following along. Talk to you again soon, Pat.
Same here, Blake. It's been a pleasure.